So, Leva, a college friend of yours once told me that your favorite meal during college was a dill pickle, beef jerky, and grape soda. Is that true?
I did indeed have that for breakfast, but to tell you the truth, it sounded better before I ate it than after.
Steve Levitt, my Freakonomics friend and co-author, an esteemed economist at the University of Chicago, has an extremely refined palate. All right, so you got beef jerky, you got dill pickle. What are your favorite foods? Like, what are your favorite places? Like, if you could drive across America and pick any place to stop and eat, what's it going to be?
You know, I love the Billy Goat Tavern. It's the cheap place that was made famous in the 19, probably 70s on Saturday Night Live with the cheeseburger, no Pepsi, Coke.
No Coke, Pepsi.
Anyway, they have an incredible ribeye steak sandwich. Pretty much the cheaper the food, the better. There's almost no fast food that I don't adore.
So KFC.
Yeah, I like KFC, burgers, Chipotle, kill for Chipotle.
So how would you describe your palate?
Probably underdeveloped. You know, but it's good. I mean, the thing is, it's a wonderful, wonderful gift to like cheap food. I mean, some people just happen to like expensive food, and then they're unhappy most of the time, or else they spend all their money on food. But if you just, by chance, are born loving cheap food, then you can eat, you know, everything that you love.
Cheeseburger?
Now, how much do you like wine?
Wine I do not like at all.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Good wine, we're told, is the province of smart, superior people. They taste things on a whole nother level than people like you and me.
Smelling a little minerality.
Freshly cut apple.
George Clinton. This funky sort of...
Baby vomit, yeah.
But I have a question for you. Is that superiority deserved? The wines that experts love, the ones that bring out the natural beauty of the grape but aren't too funky, they cost a lot more.
$450 a bottle.
But are expensive wines really that much better than cheap wines? Or is it possible that developing your palate just mucks things up, complicates things? Maybe we'd all be better off if we had taste buds like Steve Levitt's.
Kill for Chipotle.
After graduate school, Levitt was invited to join an elite club at Harvard called the Society of Fellows. A junior fellow like him was paid a modest salary to work on his own research with few obligations other than a formal Monday night dinner with the senior fellows, who were some of the most remarkable scholars alive.
People like, you know, Amartya Sen and Nobel Prize-winning physicists and whatnot. And you sit around the table, and I believe the table was Oliver Wendell Holmes' table initially, and he gifted it to Society of Fellows.
Over dinner, they engaged in witty, learned conversation. They ate venison, other fine food, and they drank expensive wine, bottle after bottle. To this budding young economist with the beef jerky taste and the grape soda budget, all that pricey wine, it wasn't doing him any good. He had a thought.
Innocently, I mean, I was young. I didn't understand how the world worked. I thought like an economist. I suggested that perhaps we should have two tracks at the Society Fellows. There would be the drinking track and the abstinence track. And for those of us who chose the abstinence track, because the cost of the wine was perhaps $60 per meal, that over the course of 50 weeks of the year, that would work out to be about $3,000, and they could add $3,000 to the paycheck of those of us on the abstinence path.
And did you have any other people in your abstinence camp, or was this just Levitt?
Well, you know, it didn't really get that far because the reaction was quite negative.
Levitt's the kind of person who likes to use data, not a personal agenda, to make his arguments. So he set out to get some data, wine data. The wine they were drinking at these dinners cost 5 or 10 times what a cheap bottle of wine cost. Was it really 5 or 10 times better? He hatched a plan. The Society of Fellows held wine tastings from time to time. He suggested that the next one be his to organize.
So I worked with the wine steward to select two excellent bottles of wine, expensive bottles of wine, probably close to $100 bottles of wine. And then I went to the liquor store that was down the street, and I said, can I have the cheapest bottle of wine you have that that was the same grape? I don't remember which grape it was.
Levitt used four decanters. Into the first decanter, he poured one of the expensive bottles of wine. The other expensive wine went into decanter number two. In the third decanter, he poured the cheap wine, which cost around $8. And in the fourth decanter, he repeated one of the expensive wines.
So as far as the people knew, there were four different wines. And these were all wines that were coming out of the wine cellar of the Society of Fellows.
So you're tricking them from the outset. You're leading them to believe that the fourth, the cheap wine, is also from the wine cellar.
I don't, you know, yes.
They swirled them a bit, sniffed them, and sipped. They wrote down their ratings. As he looked at the numbers, Levitt's cold economist heart warmed.
The data could not have cooperated more completely with my hypotheses. So for starters, the four wines received almost identical ratings on average. Although there were a widespread among individuals, on average, just tallied it up, people did not prefer the expensive wines to the cheap wine. On top of that, and this was the thing that I was hoping for and dreaming of but didn't believe it actually came true, it turned out when you made among individuals, if you compared how differently they rated any two of the wines that they had, it turned out that by a small margin, people actually rated the same wine from the same bottle but presented in a different decanter as being the most different among the two wines. So the two wines that were absolutely identical, when you looked at the gap between the ratings that an individual gave to those wines, the gap was bigger than they did between the other wines, which actually were different.
A few minutes after the tasting was over, Steve Levitt shared the results with the senior fellows.
The jovial mood in the room suddenly went dark. People realized they had been tricked, that there had been this cheap wine, the same wine was in twice, and they really realized that the nature of the game had been somewhat different than what they thought. And when they heard the results, that collectively they had no ability to identify wines, they were not happy. And in particular, there was one senior fellow, so one of the professors at Harvard, who was quite outspoken about his knowledge of wine, and he loudly announced that he had a cold. Otherwise, he clearly could have made the distinctions, and he stormed from the room and left the party prematurely.
What was his discipline?
I think for the sake of anonymity, I should not reveal that particular piece of information. He was a humanist.
Not an economist, in other words.
No.
The opposite of an economist. So what does Levitt's evil little experiment teach us about wine? Maybe not all that much. It wasn't a very scientific tasting, really. Perhaps the Society of Fellows was just having an off night. The humanist had a cold, right? Or maybe this was just a group of people who didn't know as much about wine as they thought they knew. You'd never be able to pull this kind of stunt on wine experts, would you?
On my team, we have a master sommelier, two master of wine candidates, four people that have been in the trade for many years. And these are sophisticated wine professionals.
That's Brian DeMarco talking about the people that he gathered for a blind tasting of his own. Before we get to that, let's hear a little bit more about Brian.
I specialize in helping customers, consumers, private collectors, and retailers and restaurants decide what wines to put on their list, what wines to collect, what wines to sell. And I have a small import business and wholesale company, and we distribute wine that we find all over Europe and South America in New York City.
Cool. So you're almost a wine agent then, yeah, in a way, more than just an importer?
In many ways, yes.
You are at the center of the way wine is produced and marketed and consumed, right?
I think in many ways I'm the arbiter of taste for buyers and consumers, because the things that we decide to bring in represent my palate or my team's palate much in the way that a reviewer would review a wine and discuss its merits or its lack of merit and then try to drive demand for it. So we're actually the step before a reviewer.
I see. So there are a lot of people reliant on your palate, a lot of dollars riding on your palate. How good is your palate?
I'd say pretty good.
He seemed like a nice enough guy. But how do I know that, right? How do, if I'm a buyer, if I'm a collector, if I'm a restaurant, if I'm a customer in a restaurant, how do I know?
Interesting question. Well, I'm a classically trained French chef, and I went to the French Culinary Institute, and I realized early on that much of my professional career earlier, I was good at recognizing talent more than being talented. And the thing that I like about the wine business is there's so many different and disparate styles of wine that I can appreciate each one of them for where they belong in the world and why they're good for their category. I may not love New Zealand wine more than, say, French wine, but I appreciate the New Zealand wine and I get why people like it. And I understand what's good within its classification. So it's like saying, I mean, it like hockey as a sport, but I appreciate why hockey is important and, you know, what teams are the best and the, you know, the merits of hockey. And I may appreciate football better. But so I think the interesting thing about being in the wine business is there are so many wines out there and people like them all. You can't tell them they're wrong. They're voting with their dollars.
Brian DeMarco is one of the people who decide what we drink. He goes to France, Italy, California, tastes wine fresh out of the tank. So he determines what's good or bad without any critics whispering sweet ratings into his ear. Then he puts his money where his taste buds are. He writes a check. Now, according to DeMarco, he makes as much money selling a $15 bottle of wine to a restaurant or shop as he does selling a $50 bottle. If that's true, DeMarco is an honest broker. His job is simply to find wine that you or I would want to drink. Because if you think about it, there are thousands upon thousands of bottles to choose from. Just picture the rows of bottles lining the shelves at every wine shop. You kind of, sort of, maybe think you want to buy a Merlot. So do you pick the one with the pretty flowers on the label? Do you go with the one that Robert Parker, the high priest of wine ratings, awarded a lot of his Parker points to? Or, like a lot of people, do you let price be your guide? If you believe even a little bit in the free market, you'd have to think that expensive wines cost more because they taste better, right? Brian DeMarco wanted to know how much people were tasting the dollars when they drank an expensive wine. So, like Steve Levitt, he conducted a little experiment with some of the people who work for him. As DeMarco said, these were no amateurs.
We did a tasting, a brown bag, and we had this exact same wine in both bags. And we told them that one bottle was a $50 bottle and to write their reviews. And we said another one was a $10 bottle to write their reviews. And, of course, they're both $20 bottles, according to retail, what they would sell at any retail store. And then we reversed it. And we said, now the $10 bottle is really the $50. And everyone liked the $50 bottle better in both circumstances because they perceived that the price there had to, either they thought there's something they're missing. When really, they're like, these wines are so similar. Yeah, but they're different, you know. And so a lot of people call, two or three people said, is this the same wine? And we said, well, that's for you to determine. And the more they thought about it, the more they intellectualized it, the more they decided there was differences to the wine.
So this wasn't a wildly scientific experiment either. But to Brian DeMarco, the message couldn't have been clearer. When people know a wine is more expensive, or even think it is, it tastes better. Now, obviously, this idea doesn't apply just to wine. A house that costs $500,000 ought to be five times better on some level than a $100,000 house, the size, the construction, the schools, the neighborhood. So is a wine that costs $50 five times better than a $10 bottle? Or is it even better at all? So tell me your name and kind of what you do or how you describe yourself.
My name is Robin Goldstein. I write about wine and food. My book, The Wine Trials, has been my, I guess, principal outlet for writing about wine. But I've also been publishing academic papers on topics of taste from a cognitive perspective and an economic perspective, usually co-authored with colleagues from different academic fields. So I've been exploring the neuroscience side of it a bit. I've been exploring kind of the behavioral side of it. And in particular, I'm interested in price signals and how people's knowledge of price affects their experience of wine on the most basic sensory level.
Now, First, let me just ask, I've heard good things about this lovely little restaurant in Milan called Osteria L'Intrepido. You ever been there?
I've been to the restaurant, but it's actually located in my friend Giuliano's former apartment in Milan. The restaurant really, I wouldn't say it's great. Mostly they serve leftover pizza, and their wine cellar consists mostly of some leftover bottles of Montepulciano d'Abruzzo from 3 weeks ago.
But meaning it's not really a restaurant, is it?
It's an apartment. So it's just an address, really.
Osteria L'Intrepido doesn't exist. It's a fake restaurant that Robin Goldstein made up. Why? Well, it's a strange story. Goldstein's research and writing on wine made him skeptical about critics and awards. He believed that so-called experts were at best subjective and that they carried way too much influence. He wondered about the awards that magazines like Wine Spectator gave to restaurants for their wine lists. Did an award like that really mean that the wines at that restaurant were excellent? So he invented Osteria L'Intrepido, or Fearless Restaurant. He created a fake menu, a fake website, and a fake voicemail message saying the restaurant was closed for vacation.
Questa è l'Osteria L'Intrepido di Milano. Siamo chiusi per vacanze. Per favore, lasciate un messaggio. Grazie.
As for the Osteria L'Intrepido wine list, Goldstein made that up too. He included several expensive wines that Wine Spectator itself had given bad reviews in the past. One of them was a 1982 Brunello di Montalcino, which the magazine had given 67 points, or a D-plus rating, calling it barnyardy and decayed. He listed another vintage that Wine Spectator had reviewed as unacceptable, sweet and cloying, and smells like bug spray. Then off his application went, with the fake wine list and a real money order.
My hypothesis was that the $250 fee was really the functional part of the application. In other words, that the entire awards program was really just an advertising scheme, and that it was being fraudulently misrepresented as an exercise of expert judgment by Wine Spectator.
I see. Now, was a little piece of you expecting that when you applied for this, that they would send someone around to drink some of your wine or eat some of your food?
Well, of course, that's the experiment, right? So I didn't know. I mean, I wasn't sure going into this that I would win an award. There were two questions being tested here. One was, do you have to have a good wine list to win a Wine Spectator Award of Excellence? And the second was, do you have to exist to win a Wine Spectator Award of Excellence? And so I thought that it was quite possible that my experiment would fail.
He didn't fail.
I am calling from the Wine Spectator magazine in New York, calling to congratulate you and let you know that your restaurant was selected as a Wine Spectator Restaurant Award winner. Hopefully you did receive some information from us, but I'm calling to follow up and see if you might have an interest in publicizing your award with an ad in the upcoming issue, which comes out in August, as we do have a lot of international business travelers who may be coming to Milan.
And what was the name of the award that you won for your fictional restaurant?
The Wine Spectator Award of Excellence.
So congratulations. That's awesome that you're a winner.
Thank you.
I, too, could be a winner, presumably?
Yeah, if your wines were bad enough.
So have a great day. Bye-bye.
In August of 2008, a new organization called the American Association of Wine Economists held its annual conference in Portland, Oregon. That's where Goldstein revealed his fake award of excellence. The press drank it up. From the New York Post, Wine Mag humbled by hoax. According to the LA Times, Wine Spectator was now drinking a hearty glass of blush. Wine Spectator vigorously defended its award system. The executive editor said the magazine never claimed to visit every restaurant and that it did its due diligence on Osteria L'Intrepido, looking over its website and calling the restaurant, but that it kept reaching an answering machine.
Grazie.
Robin Goldstein, for his part, was convinced. The wine system was fundamentally flawed. If a fake restaurant with a wine list that included bad, expensive wines could win an award of excellence from one of the most prestigious wine magazines in the world, who are we supposed to trust?
My takeaway is that expert sources in the media are trusted too much, and that they're prone to abusing their positions of power as a way of making money. So the phenomenon where an ad, what's really an ad, is posing as real expert judgment, is very problematic for consumers, because consumers really put trust in these magazines. We put trust in experts. There's so many fields out there that we don't know as much about as the experts do. And so we use experts as an information intermediary, as a proxy for good judgment, and in an area that we don't know as much as the experts are supposed to. And when we trust experts too much and they sell their awards to entities that are really their customers, that's quite problematic.
Robin Goldstein also had an academic paper to present at that conference of wine economists. The paper was called "Do More Expensive Wines Taste Better?" If the Osorial Intrepido stunt was just a stunt, and if the Steve Levitt and Brian DeMarco blind tastings we heard about earlier were just unscientific tricks, well, Goldstein's paper was the opposite of that. It gathered up data from 17 blind tastings that Goldstein himself organized. The data included more than 6,000 observations from more than 500 people, from amateur wine drinkers to sommeliers and winemakers. He tested red wines, whites, rosés. The prices ranged from $1.65 a bottle to $150 a bottle. It was as rigorous as you could get. And what did Goldstein learn? That overall, people liked expensive wines less than cheap wines. When you don't know what a bottle of wine costs, apparently you don't know how good it's supposed to taste. Even the most expert tasters could barely tell the difference between expensive wines and cheap ones. It's unsettling, isn't it? Buying a bottle of wine shouldn't be as complicated as buying a house. But thanks to the layers of experts between us and the grapes, we've got performance anxiety. Wine isn't supposed to be a drag. It's a celebration, a beloved recipe, civilization in a bottle. You are drinking the handcrafted fruit of some farmer's vines that may go back hundreds of years, grown under the same sun that's been shining for billions of years. Wouldn't it be nice to drop the pretense, to set aside the ratings and price, and just drink? Brian DeMarco, the wine importer, that's what he's really after.
Who are we to tell the Connecticut housewife that that oaky Chardonnay she's been slamming down for the last 10 years from California, she's not deriving pleasure from that. She surely is. But there are so many other things. It's like limiting your musical notes to only playing F and C notes the rest of your life. It's only eating cheeseburgers and hamburgers, you know, the rest of your life. If you want to try other foods and other cultures and other things, if opening this bottle of Rioja somehow takes you to Spain and makes you feel like you want tapas, then it's done its job. And whether it's a $15 bottle or a $30 bottle is irrelevant at that point. I mean, then you're getting into nuances of good and great. But I think the bottle of wine is the ability to either change your day from an alcoholic standpoint, getting to a certain point where you're like, okay, this is, or for people like myself in the trade, it's something you have with food. I mean, growing up in an Italian household, we weren't drinking great wine, but to me, wine was an alcohol. Wine was Carlo Rossi in a jug that was poured into juice glasses from my grandfather, and that was what you had with dinner. Drinking to me was Budweiser and Jack Daniels, you know, sneaking out on Friday night to go drink.
Let me just ask you, we're sitting here in a radio studio in downtown New York with kind of mucus-colored sound padding and artificial light, and there's basically nothing good about this space. There's no air, there's nothing. But
soulless.
But transport me for a minute. So tell me, Brian, the room that you would like to be sitting in right now and the food that you'd like to be eating right now, and most of all, what the wine is with that food and what that wine tastes like to you.
I think a crisp Sancerre would be perfect right now, and with some sort of croque monsieur, and maybe, a salad with a little vinaigrette and would be kind of perfect. You know, not too decadent, but definitely has its place, and maybe have a backup bottle on ice.
Has your table got room for another guy there?
You're sitting with me right now. this pressed wood table is, I think it can hold an ice bucket. I'm pretty confident.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, do we care more about animals' lives than the lives of our fellow humans?
And there was such little coverage about that event and so much coverage about the killing of one giraffe that it simply struck me that that probably says something about how we think and about the nature of our society.
Also, please take advantage of our free weekly Freakonomics Radio podcast, which you can find at Freakonomics.com on iTunes or any other podcast delivery system. Thanks.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio with your host, Stephen Dubner.
Oh, you know I love animals, and I particularly love giraffes.
That's Steve Levitt, my Freakonomics friend and co-author. He's a giraffe-loving economist at the University of Chicago.
One of the high points of my life was when a giraffe stuck his 3-foot-long tongue out and licked me all over the face.
Really? Where did that happen? Was that in a private setting or in a zoo?
In Wisconsin Dells, of all places. You can do anything in Wisconsin Dells.
And what was your response to that? Did you just fall in love with him?
It was crazy. I mean, the tongue was amazing.
Hmm. Any idea why he chose you?
Because I had a bunch of food, which I had purchased in order to get him to do that.
So you already loved giraffes by the time that happened?
Absolutely.
So how would you have felt then if 5 minutes after that incredibly intense, intimate bonding moment, the zookeeper had come up and taken this giraffe and put a bullet in its head in front of your eyes and your kid's eyes?
I would have felt outraged.
Okay, so as you may know, this scenario I described to Steve Levitt, the sudden and very public death of a zoo giraffe, wasn't imaginary. It really happened at the Copenhagen Zoo in Denmark. Although later, I realized it happened not quite the way I remembered it. The giraffe wasn't killed in public. That happened out of sight. But he was later butchered in front of a large crowd of onlookers, including children. The giraffe was named Marius.
Marius, a dewy-eyed, perfectly healthy 18-month-old giraffe, has been wandering in and out of his stall, blissfully unaware of his impending fate. His misfortune...
Here, speaking through an interpreter, is the veterinarian who did the deed.
The giraffe walked out here at 9:15 and was led out into its yard over there. Then there was a zookeeper with some rye bread. He really likes rye bread. And he said, "Here you go, Marius. Here's some rye bread." I stood behind with a rifle, and when he put his head forward and ate the rye bread, I shot him straight through the brain. It sounds violent, but it means that Marius...
Then the vet butchered Marius's corpse. The giraffe meat would be fed to the zoo's lions and tigers and polar bears. The zoo made clear that it killed Marius out of kindness to some degree.
Marius was 2 years old, healthy and happy. But not allowed to breed, genetically too similar to the other giraffes. Copenhagen Zoo said Marius would break European rules on inbreeding. Their view was that castrating Marius and not allowing him to be a father would be cruel. It was kinder to kill him.
Much of the world did not see it that way.
Marius ist tot. Der eineinhalbjährige Giraffe.
Marius, bébé girafe.
Au Danemark, ce bébé girafe appelé Marius.
Marius, una jirafa varón en estado sano de salud, fue sofocado.
I think it's wrong. You don't put down a young and healthy animal. I know life is a cycle and lions don't eat porridge. I know that.
So outrage has escalated to death threats. That's right, death threats against some of the staff at the Copenhagen Zoo.
It's not hard to understand why so many people were so upset by the assassination of a zoo giraffe. Steve Levitt, who gets outraged at almost nothing, admits that even he would have felt outraged. So you'd think that if we can exhibit so much emotion over the fate of one animal, we'd surely exhibit even more emotion over the fate of hundreds of thousands of the human animal, wouldn't you?
Okay. Ami?
Yeah, hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm really good. Thanks.
Emil Hirsch is senior rabbi at the Stephen Wise Free Synagogue in New York City. He's a friend of mine. The Stephen Wise congregation has a long tradition of being on the right side of history when it comes to human rights and civil rights. We are speaking today because of a sermon I heard you give about, I believe it was called Obligations and Deeds, but really the passage in particular that really struck me was the passage about the giraffe. So I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind just reading or paraphrasing that brief part of the sermon for me.
Sure. It struck me because if you recall that week, there was saturation coverage of a Danish zoo that killed a giraffe in front of dozens of school children and fed it to the lions. And it struck me that that received so much attention and so much publicity. Not that I'm in favor of killing giraffes in general or killing any animals, let alone in front of children. But it was at the time when there was such savagery around the world. In particular, hundreds of people on that week were butchered in Syria. And there was such little coverage about that event and so much coverage about the killing of one giraffe. That it simply struck me that that probably says something about how we think and about the nature of our society.
So what does it say about us, whether the us is modern humans or just humans throughout time, that we can get so upset over things with such relatively low stakes? I mean, look, a giraffe, I feel bad for the giraffe too, but it's one giraffe in Copenhagen. So we can get upset over something like that, but we don't get very upset, I think most of us would agree, over a lot of real human suffering. The example you cite, the Syrian civil war. What does that say?
It says we still have a lot of work to do. Now, we do that work by laws and by expectations and by obligations, by enormous education from the very beginning. We tap into something that on its face is good in the human character, which is compassion for animals. By the way, I would add parenthetically that Judaism has an enormous school of thought and enormous teachings about the importance of being kind and compassionate to animals. But we also need to teach ourselves and our children priorities. You know, we need to establish priorities. That's something that religion, too, is quite preoccupied with. That is, how do you decide what to do? Not that there is a black and white, good and evil, that is completely clear, which is self-evident, but when there are competing goods or competing aims, how do you rank the good of not killing a giraffe in front of several dozen schoolchildren with not killing several dozen schoolchildren in some war-torn country? That's really where we need to put our emphasis, and that's hard. That's hard thinking, that's hard decision-making, that's hard teaching, and it requires us to make decisions on competing values.
I wonder, as I hear you say that, I wonder if somehow we might choose to exercise outrage over something like, you know, a giraffe being killed in front of children more than children themselves being killed in Syria. I wonder if partly we get outraged over the giraffe more because the human suffering is just too difficult for us, that it's too existentially painful.
That might be. That might be. First of all, we are able to sympathize and empathize with people and with creatures who are in front of us. I walk across Central Park every day and on the way to work. And there are, of course, dozens and dozens of dog owners walking their dogs. And I notice that people treat their pets with enormous sensitivity. Very often I see cases in the park where they treat animals with much greater sensitivity and compassion than they treat human beings.
So there are a number of ways to look at this, right? It may be, as I suggested to Rabbi Hirsch, that human suffering is just too painful for us to deal with. But we should also acknowledge that showing such widespread compassion for animals
is a positive step in the course of human development. Here's how Steve Levitt thinks about this from an economist's perspective.
I think being nice to animals is a luxury good. I remember when I first went to China 14 years ago to adopt my daughter, and we went to an open-air market, and the animals they had to eat and the circumstances of these animals was just, to a Westerner, was outrageous. I mean, just they would eat anything seemingly, and the, you know, things were skinned and cats were in cages. I mean, it was crazy. And then when I went back about 5 years later to the same open-air market, what just amazed me is that suddenly they had a big section of the open-air market was devoted to fish tanks. And people had gone, in just 5 years, that China had boomed in wealth from literally eating anything they could find to deciding it was fun to have animals for pets. And it really hit home to me, the idea that when you're hungry and you're poor, the only thing you want out of an animal is to serve your needs. And then once you get rich and not so hungry, and then you want animals to play with. And, you know, that's what's happening, I think, with the U.S. and the idea of organic and happy meat, you know, and stuff like that.
Did you just call it happy meat?
Yeah, what do they call it?
Yeah, happy meat. That's what they call it. Now, Levitt, how do you feel about guacamole?
I love guacamole.
Mm. Do you feel any moral qualms about eating guacamole, let's say?
I have never had one moral qualm about eating guacamole.
Can I give you a reason to perhaps consider having a moral qualm about guacamole?
Sure. It will only make me worse off, but go ahead and do it.
If you'd rather me not spoil it for you, I don't have to.
I think I'm willing to take the hit so our listeners can get the pleasure of watching me suffer.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, if you are going to feel bad about animals being killed, whether for food or because of their genetic makeup, then you may want to re-examine your feelings about avocados.
There are no conflict-free avocados.
And could it just be that humans are our least favorite animal?
I mean, my kids would gladly trade a human for a polar bear any day of the week.
If you want to hear more Freakonomics Radio, check out our website at Freakonomics.com, where you can find the podcast, our books, a blog, and much more.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Hi, Jose.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Hey, good. This is Stephen Dubner. Nice to meet you.
Hey, Stephen. Same here.
I recently had a conversation with a fellow named Jose de Cordoba.
I'm a reporter for the Wall Street Journal based in Mexico. I not only cover Mexico, but large areas in Latin America, depending where the news is coming from. I'm Cuban. Originally, I left Cuba in 1960, about 2 years after the revolution, when the government confiscated my family's, my grandparents' business. And I grew up in New York and Puerto Rico, and I got into journalism because when I was young, I liked to write poetry, and but there was no future in that. I figured that, and I was very interested in politics because of my own personal history, and I was very interested in Latin America, so I thought journalism would be the best way to join all my interests together.
De Cordoba wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal that, for whatever reason, did not provoke the kind of outrage that accompanied the killing of Marius the giraffe. But after hearing his story, you may wonder why it didn't.
It was totally random. I wasn't looking to do a story about avocados at all. I was going to do a profile.
The man he wanted to profile was a vigilante leader who was trying to get other people to join him in fighting a crime and drug cartel known as the Knights Templar.
It used to be called La Familia and now it's known as the Knights Templars. They're basically a huge extortion operation. They extort everybody and everything in Michoacán. Everything that moves is extorted.
So De Cordoba was in the state of Michoacán, which is on Mexico's Pacific coast, and he was following this vigilante leader around.
We ended up in this little town Tansintaro up in the mountains, which is the setting for the story.
He had no idea how big the avocado industry is in this area.
We entered the town through avocado groves. Then we passed this little, the statue of an avocado right in front of the town, and took note of that.
As it turns out, 80% of the avocados sold in the U.S. are grown in Michoacán, about 500,000 tons of avocados a year. More than 150,000 tons come from this one town, Tansintaro. But it wasn't just the avocado statue that caught De Cordoba's eye when he drove into town.
There are two burnt-out, giant packing, export packing houses, big, you know, big, big businesses for the area. And they were burned down on the same night.
So what happened? As best as he could tell, these avocado packing houses got torched because their owners didn't pay the local criminal gang, the Knights Templar, the protection money they were supposed to.
I was able to talk to a small packer, and he gave me the details about what he was paying. Growers who know the big packers say they're paying from anything from like $15,000 a month to $20,000 a month.
And it's not just getting a cut from sales of, you know, the avocados themselves and the packing and the trucking. You write that there's a cut of, let's say, fertilizer sales and so on, yes?
Yeah, all up the production chain, people have to pay off the Templars, or were paying off the Templars, you know, the guys who provide the fertilizers, the guys who provide the insecticide, the people who provide the workers to go out and harvest the avocados, the trucks that transport the avocados to the packing houses, and so on.
Okay, and what happens if I'm a trucker or a packing firm or a farm and I decide to not pay you?
Well, you got big problems. If you're a grower, and this may happen anyway, but you might have a family member kidnapped and held for ransom.
That is exactly what happened to one local avocado grower.
What happened was that the daughter of a local Jehovah's Witnesses preacher, a person who was much esteemed in the area, Maria Irene Villanueva, was kidnapped by the local Templar head, a guy named El Seco, the dry one. And he demanded an 8 million peso ransom for her, which was something like $600,000. The father, who owned a small avocado grove, basically couldn't come up with the money. So what he was going to do was going to give the Templars his avocado grove in payment for his daughter. In the middle of all this, for some reason, she was killed. She was murdered. She was shot.
This murder, De Cordoba says, swung the local momentum in favor of the vigilantes. But the Knights kept up their extortion. In 2013, they made an estimated $150 million from so-called protection money.
They're named after the Knights Templars, a medieval order of warrior monks. But they are enormously violent. And what has happened is that their main source of income was trafficking marijuana, meth, and cocaine. But they have branched out. And now I think they're by far, they get much more income from all their different extortion rackets, which go from extorting avocados to extorting iron ore mines to extorting forest products. But they extort also everybody. So, like, if from a national pharmacy chain and you want to open up a pharmacy in some town in Michoacán, you're going to have to pay a payment there. The tortilla makers pay extortion to these guys. Everybody does.
I'm curious about the impact of your article. So you wrote an article saying that a vigilante group has risen up to fight back against this incredible extortion of avocado farmers. Has it changed anything, first of all, in Mexico on the ground?
Well, I'm not sure that my article per se has changed things in Mexico on the ground. The whole vigilante movement had taken on a lot of strength as I was writing this. What has happened is that the Mexican government, which had basically been pretty absent from Michoacán, I mean, one of the big problems was that there was a real vacuum of power and that the Mexican government seemed to be a lot more interested in all the reforms that they've been able to pass in the last year. You know, they passed an oil reform, they passed a telecommunications reform, and other reforms. And they took kind of their eye off the ball in terms of Mexico's continuing security problems. So they, what happened, without my article having an impact on this, was that the whole problem in Michoacán sort of blew up. And it made the Mexican government take a, you know, focus on Michoacán because it was sort of ruining their international agenda.
When's the last time you had an avocado?
I eat them most days. I love avocados.
Has this changed your consumption at all or no?
No, I love eating avocados. As a matter of fact, I think I'm eating more since I went up there.
Do you don't try to seek out kind of conflict-free avocados?
There are no conflict-free avocados. No.
So, if you live in the U.S. and you eat avocados or mangoes or limes or other produce that comes from Mexico, there's a pretty good chance that some of the money you paid supports a violent criminal gang. So, that guacamole you're eating? Made from blood avocados. Where is the outrage over that? If we're going to shed a tear over Marius the giraffe, how about we do the same for Maria Arena Villanueva, the preacher's daughter who was allegedly murdered by the Mexican gang because her father didn't pay his avocado protection money? The animal rights movement has gained a lot of strength in recent years. Most of us would agree that's a good thing. Some people have given up eating animals entirely to honor that movement. But the closer you look at what we eat and what we consume more generally, the more confusing the moral calculus becomes. So should we stop eating avocados and mangoes and limes too? Jose de Cordoba, the Wall Street Journal reporter in Mexico, he doesn't think so.
If you do that, you're going to be throwing a hell of a lot of people out of business in Mexico. And they, that's about the only business that in that area that is, you know, the one and only business. I really do think it's a Mexican problem. I don't think the U.S. consumer should have to carry the weight of Mexico's blood avocados on their shoulders or whatever. You know, I mean, Mexico has to get its act together in terms of justice, in terms of being a state of law, you know? You can't allow these guys to run around and do this extortion.
I really think of the market as somehow getting me out of any moral obligation.
That's Steve Levitt again.
I mean, when I go to the store, if the grocery store wants to sell me meat at some price, then the world's too complicated, I think, for me to try to figure out every transaction along the way and whether it was fair and whether it was fair to the people or the animals. And so I just figure that's the problem someone else has got to work out, the government or the producers or the ethicists. They figure out what's right and wrong. And then I feel like if I'm doing a market transaction, I don't really need necessarily to feel any guilt about it.
All right. So let me ask you this. Person A, not you, not me. Person A walks into a restaurant and has a choice between eating, let's say, some chicken that has been raised and slaughtered in a traditional manner, meaning it's not happy meat, right? It hasn't had the most wonderful chicken life ever. Have a choice between eating the chicken that may have suffered or the guacamole made from the avocados, which have an extortion tax built in, some of which money went to criminals who may have tortured, killed, kidnapped, raped the people associated with growing avocados. What's a person to do?
Well, my basic answer, which is a horrible answer, which people will hate, is that any individual person can't really do anything. And if you love guacamole...
It's not what Gandhi said.
I mean, it's tough. I mean, obviously, there is a pull and there's a maybe a warmth and a goodness that comes from saying, having learned this, I will never eat avocados again. Having learned about the way chickens are raised, I will not eat chickens. But there's a pragmatism that comes with trying to live your life. And is it really true that anything will change in the avocado region if I stop eating guacamole? Well, no. So it's one of those things where you can take an action because it matters, because it actually affects outcomes and other people's lives and prices and how many avocados are made. Or you can make an action because it's the right thing to do and because it feels good to do the right thing and because it's important to do the right thing. But I think it helps to be able to separate those two in your mind. I think people who do the right thing a lot, they get confused and they think that by doing the right thing, like not eating avocados, people get the idea that somehow they're making the world a better place. But they're really not. You know, to the first order, what they're doing is they're making themselves feel good and they're not affecting what I would call, say, the equilibrium. But that's great. That's fine. But I think it's important when you make sacrifices to understand what your sacrifice actually accomplishes and what it fails to accomplish.
Mm, that's a good way of putting it. So it strikes me that we humans are pretty good at selective outrage. We get really distraught about one type of offense. Maybe it's a moral offense. Whereas another one that may be very similar and maybe even be much larger and more egregious, we don't get upset about just because of the nature of what that offense is. So as a friend pointed out, when this giraffe was murdered in cold blood in this Copenhagen zoo, the world was aghast. And yet at the very same time, in Syria and many other places, there was horrible violence against humans happening that the world didn't care about at all. So is this just a function of the way we filter information and get a little bit and act on what we hear and that's just the way it is? Or does it say something about our kind of appetite to get upset about things where the stakes kind of are lower? I mean, really, you know, one dead giraffe in a zoo really doesn't affect any of us, whereas tens or hundreds of thousands of people in some country being tormented, the stakes are very high, and yet we don't seem to be able to do anything about that either.
Yeah, I think what it really tells us is about the power of a good story. And Marius is an amazing story. It got all the elements that make stories exciting and good and moral and telling. And Syria isn't. Syria is a mess. You know, who knows what's going on in Syria? And indeed, I think a story about a single Syrian person is 1,000 times more powerful than a story about 1,000 Syrian people dying. And that to me ultimately is the power of storytelling, and you know, both for good and for evil. And I think that's what's going on, is Marius is like the greatest story ever.
Maybe that's all it is. Maybe Marius caught the world's attention just because it was a particularly gripping story. But it could also be that as much as we humans talk the talk about caring for our fellow humans, when it's time to walk the walk, we actually prefer non-human animals. The kind of animal that doesn't talk and so can't say something we might disagree with. The kind of animal that hasn't made some sort of stupid or malicious decision that we morally object to. The kind of animal that we learn to love so much that not only do we never want to eat it, but we do anything we can to save its life.
You know, it's funny, and I learned this from my kids, but really, people, unless you press them, their natural reaction is to like animals better than other people. And you can see it with polar bears, right? The most effective thing that the climate change people have ever done is to show polar bears floating on little ice blocks in the Arctic Ocean. I mean, my kids would gladly trade a human for a polar bear any day of the week.
Levitt, a listener named Rebecca Pierce wrote in with a scenario. Okay, it's a question you have to answer. You're standing alone in the Arctic with a gun, which sounds like a place I could imagine Levitt being. Suddenly, you're attacked by a polar bear, the absolute last one left on Earth. Do you kill it or yourself?
Who sent us this question?
Her name is Rebecca Pierce.
Okay, Rebecca, let me just say this. If there's only one polar bear left, that means there aren't going to be any polar bears in the future. And whether I kill that polar bear now or it dies on its own in a few years doesn't matter. So I definitely do everything I can to kill the polar bear.
Not the answer I was expecting. So kind of on a technicality, you're going to, right? But I was
thinking, if there were two polar bears, a girl bear and a boy bear, then it would be a much harder
choice. Whole other story there. And Levitt, yeah. But I was imagining that you were just going to try to line yourself and the bear up with one bullet. That's the answer that I was envisioning for you. I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. We'll be back next week. If you can't wait that long, you can get our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at iTunes, where you can also subscribe. Thanks for listening.